happy birthday greetings today to Carolyn Buster of Winfield, to William Finnegan from West Des Moines, and to Kay Eileen Vannis from Central City. A very happy birthday to all three of you. We hope this is a great day for you. A couple of older actresses are joining you on your birthday today. These are names that you may be familiar with, having seen, no doubt, lots of their work over the years. Claire Bloom turns 93 today, and Jane Seymour turns 73. So a happy birthday to everyone, and we hope that if today is your birthday and we didn't say your name, that you're having a happy birthday today anyway. So you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. Now here's Dave with our first obituary.
Thank you, Twyla. I will now take a look at a couple short death notices before we launch into the obituaries. Helen Hill, age 87, of Runnels, Iowa, passed away on February 12th. Hamilton's Altoona Funeral Home will make the arrangements. The service time is February 19th at 12 p.m., and the service location is Altoona Funeral Home, and interment will be in Loman Cemetery. James Jimmy Mack McFadden, age 64, of Des Moines, passed away on February 11th. The arrangements are being made by Isles Westover Chapel. Service time and date, January 20th at 10 a.m. at the Isles Westover Chapel. And interment will be at Calvary Cemetery in Sioux City. In remembrance of Gerald Ramsey Anderson, Jr. of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Gerald had several nicknames here. He went by G.R., Jerry, Ace, and Iffy, I-F-F-Y. He was age 53, and he died on February 10th after a long illness. He graduated from Orono, that's O-R-O-N-O, High School, Drake University, and Columbia Journalism School. Services will be held at St. Martin's by the Lake Episcopal Church at 2801 Westwood Road, Minnetonka Beach, Minnesota, on Friday, February 16th of 2024. The family visitation will begin at 12:30. Memorial service beginning at 1:30 p.m., reception following the service. And you can, if you'd like to make a memorial, do it directly to the family, David Lee Funeral Home, and that's Wayzata. And the phone number for more details, 952-473-5577. In remembrance of Wilma Ann Adams Ellis, age 67, of Perry, died Monday, February 12th, at the Unity Point Health Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until the time of service at 11 a.m. on Friday, February 16th, 2024, at the First United Methodist Church, and that's located on 3rd Street in Perry. Burial will be in Oak Hill Cemetery in Clermont, Missouri. In lieu of flowers, please direct memorial contributions to the Unity Point Health Des Moines Foundation in Wilma's name. Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory in Perry is in charge of the arrangements. Elizabeth Schroeder, that's Elizabeth Ann Schroeder, age 88, died Monday, February 12th, in her home in Urbandale, Iowa, surrounded by her children. Funeral services will be held at 12 p.m. Saturday, February 17th, at St. Mary of Nazareth Catholic Church in Des Moines, with a luncheon to follow. The family will receive friends 1 hour prior to the service at the church. Private interment will be at McDivitt Grove Cemetery in Urbandale. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to St. Jude's Children's Hospital or St. Mary's of Nazareth Catholic Church. For a full obituary and online condolences, please visit www.islescares.com. Brung Duck Song of West Des Moines, age 85, passed away on Tuesday, February 13, 2024. Visitation with the family will be from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. on Saturday, February 17th of 2024, at McLaren's Rest Haven Chapel in West Des Moines. Funeral services will follow at 12 p.m. The family would like to give special thanks to the nurses and staff at University Park Nursing and Rehabilitation, as well as the hospice staff from Suncrest Home Health and Hospice, whose response, care, and compassion during a difficult time were very much appreciated. You can visit www.mclarenresthavenchapel.com for more information.
And continuing with obituaries, Billy G. Langstrom, this is from Burlington, Iowa. Mr. Langstrom was 80 years of age when he passed away on Wednesday, February 7, at his home surrounded by his loving family. A celebration of life gathering will be held later this spring at a place to be determined. Mr. Langstrom was survived by his wife, his children, Robert and Sherry, several grandchildren and great-grandchildren, nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents. Memorial donations may be directed to the family, where they will donate to a golf charity of their choice. Online condolences and a full obituary can be found at iowacremation.com under obituaries. Mavis Strike of Perry, of age 97, died on February 17. Funeral services for her have been set for 12 o'clock noon on Saturday, February 17, at First Christian Church in Perry. Burial will follow at Violet Hill Cemetery. Visitation with family greeting friends will be from 10 to 11:45 a.m. on Saturday at the church. Mavis passed away on Monday, February 12, at the Lutheran home, Eden Acres. Memorials may be made to First Christian Church or Perry Fine Arts and may be sent to Murdoch Funeral Home. And you may find an opportunity to leave condolences and read a full obituary on the Murdoch Funeral Home website. From Fort Dodge, Patricia Ann Meacham Frey Reynoldson was born on the family farm where her father was born, southeast of Weldon, Iowa. She was the second daughter of Edna Lockwood Meacham and Lawrence Alfred Meacham. Patricia, sometimes called Pat, died on February 11 at Friendship Haven Retirement Community in Fort Dodge, Iowa, where she had resided since November of 2022. She is survived by a large number of family members and preceded in death by her first husband and her second husband, the first husband, Robert Frey, and her second husband, Ward Reynoldson. Pat's kindness, generosity, and unwavering loyalty touched the lives of her family, friends, and many others who were blessed by her presence in their lives. Memorials may be directed to Friendship Haven Good Samaritan Fund. A memorial service will begin at 1 p.m. Monday, February 19 at Isle Dunn Chapel on Grand Avenue in Des Moines. The family will greet friends following the service. And Katie Mays' obituary begins like this. It is with heavy hearts that we announce the passing of our beloved Katie May. She was a woman who embodied the true essence of love, warmth, and compassion. Katie was born on January 19, 1944, to Ralph and Ann Dunn in Des Moines, Iowa, and died peacefully at home on Tuesday, February 13. She was 80 years old. Services will be held at Sacred Heart Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. Visitation from 9 to 10 a.m. with a funeral mass to follow at 10 a.m. All are invited to, the family invites all who were touched by her kindness and grace to join them in celebrating her remarkable life. A private family burial at Rest Haven Cemetery will follow. May Katie's faithful soul find eternal peace with her Father in heaven, and may her light continue to shine upon us. And finally, Marguerite A. Knoll, sometimes referred to as Sis, age 73, passed away peacefully on February 12. Visitation will begin at 1 p.m. Saturday, February 17, followed by a funeral service at 2 p.m., all at Isles Westover Chapel on Hickman Road in Des Moines. Cremation will follow the service, and interment will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday, February 18, at Restland Cemetery in Baxter, Iowa. Memorial contributions in memory of Marguerite may be directed to Crest Services Foundation. You may check their website for more information. Easter Seals of Iowa, again, the website will have more information. Or Westover Baptist Church, of which she was a longtime member. Again, you may refer to Westover Baptist Church for more information to their website. For those unable to attend the funeral service, it will be live streamed. Please go to Marguerite's obituary page on the Isles Care website for the link and to leave condolences. And now, with our next news story, here's Dave.
Iowa Republicans again vote in favor of Mayorkas impeachment. And I'm finding this story on page 2A of Section A of the Des Moines Register. Brianne Pfaffenstiel and Ken Tran submitted this story. Iowa's four Republican U.S. representatives voted again Tuesday to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas after a previous effort narrowly failed. The vote passed mostly along party lines by a count of 214 to 213, with no Democrats supporting the effort and a few GOP lawmakers joining them in opposition. Until Tuesday evening's vote, the House had not impeached a cabinet secretary in almost 150 years. The crux of House Republicans' allegations against Mayorkas, whom they have long sought to impeach, is that the secretary deliberately and willfully allowed the crisis on the southern border to reach an extreme state. 3rd District U.S. Republican Zach Nunn issued a statement Wednesday morning explaining his decision to move forward with impeachment after choosing not to comment on the previous vote. He said Mayorkas is responsible for the worst humanitarian and national security crisis in our nation's history. Today, I voted for accountability for the failed policies that have impacted neighborhoods across Iowa, he said. The American people are tired of unelected bureaucrats failing to protect our country. To best serve the American people, both Republicans and Democrats must put the interests of our country ahead of political expediency and solve the crisis at our southern border. U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, who represents the 1st District, is the only member of Iowa's House delegation who has not issued a statement about the impeachment effort. U.S. Representative Ashley Henson of the 2nd District said in a statement last week that at this point, if Mayorkas's mouth is moving, he's lying. And U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra of the 4th District said last week that Mayorkas's dereliction of duty has proven catastrophic, not only for communities along the border, but also our Iowa communities right here at home in Iowa. But Democrats, a handful of GOP lawmakers, and legal scholars across the political spectrum have argued that House Republicans' accusations amount to nothing more than policy disagreements over immigration. Policy debates, they argue, aren't the high crimes or misdemeanors the Constitution requires for impeachment. Skeptics of the effort have raised concerns that impeaching Mayorkas could have a ripple effect, politicizing future impeachments. The Iowa Democratic Party was critical of Iowa Republicans, arguing that if they were serious about solving the crisis on the southern border with Mexico, they would not have rejected a bipartisan deal meant to address the situation. Marionette Miller Meeks, Zach Nunn, and our entire congressional delegation showed us exactly what their priorities are last night, Iowa Democratic Party spokesman Paige Godin said in a statement Wednesday. Instead of working across the aisle to do anything concrete towards addressing the border's crisis, like the Senate negotiators did, they all followed Trump's commands and eschewed real progress in favor of virtue signaling. From wasting a month being unable to choose a speaker to ending the year as one of the least productive Congresses, Iowa's delegation only continues, creating more reasons to vote for new leadership this November. Twyla?
Thanks, Dave. Further on in the front page section, there is another story about the Mayorkas impeachment. And I'm not going to read the whole story. I'm just going to read parts of it, since much of it is repetitive regarding the story that Dave just read. But I'm going to read a little bit from this before we go on to another article about politics. And this is also from USA Today. And it says, ultimately, nothing will result from Tuesday night's vote to impeach Mayorkas. The Senate has the power to hold a trial to remove an impeached official, but Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, called the proceedings a sham after the vote. Once senators return from their two-week recess later this month, they will be sworn as jurors in a trial the next day, Schumer said in a statement. While members will be sworn in to be jurors, it's not clear if there's an appetite among lawmakers to sit through a trial. Even if a trial were to be scheduled, Mayorkas would almost certainly be acquitted in the Democrat-controlled Senate. House Republicans tried to impeach the official last week, but they failed in a spectacular fashion when the vote was tied 215 to 215. A tie is not enough for a vote to pass the House. Only one member, House Majority Leader Senate Steve Scalise, a Republican of Louisiana, was absent. Three Republicans, Representative Ken Buck of Colorado, Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, and Tom McClintock of California, joined Democrats to sink the initial effort. They voted again on Tuesday night against impeachment. And in other political news, Democrat Swazi wins the New York seat that Santos held. In a local race with national implications, Democrats took back the congressional seat held briefly by disgraced Republican George Santos. Voters in New York's 3rd congressional district chose former U.S. Representative Tom Suozzi in a special election Tuesday night over Nassau County legislator Mazie Pillip. The win is a big boost for Democrats in the House. Republicans were fighting to keep their razor-thin majority. Swazi's win in the Long Island area district shifts power in the lower chamber toward Democrats. With the party breakdown in the House moving to 19-13, House Republicans will soon have even less breathing room to pass partisan legislation. They can afford only 2 defectors if they want to pass anything without Democratic support. Santos last year became just the 6th lawmaker to be expelled from the House in the country's history. He faces a multitude of federal charges, including money laundering, wire fraud, identity theft, credit card fraud, and lying to Congress. He told CNN he would stay home on Tuesday. There's 2 Democrats on the ballot, and the option is to do we get a Democrat or a Democrat-Republican light version of a Democrat, Santos said. Pillip is technically still registered as a Democrat in New York, but is serving as a Republican and said her views were more in line with those of the Republican Party. I will not bring myself to vote for a registered Democrat, period, Santos says. It's just against what I believe in, he added. There was no primary for the bellwether election. Instead, the parties chose their nominees. Swazi represented the district for 3 terms before running an unsuccessful gubernatorial campaign in 2022. County and state Democratic chairs said in a statement that he, quote, has a proven record of fighting for his constituents, fighting to safeguard our suburban way of life here on Long Island and Queens, and always advocating for sensible solutions to the real challenges affecting everyday average Americans. That's an end of the quote from the county and state Democrats. Pillip, 44, is an Ethiopian-born legislator who fled to Israel as a child during Operation Solomon, a 1991 Israeli military operation that brought thousands of Ethiopian Jews to Israel, according to the Jewish Telegraph Agency. She served as a paratrooper in the Israeli Defense Forces. In the campaign's lone debate, Swazi pressed Pillip on abortion, asking asking repeatedly, "You're pro-choice?" he asked. Philip pushed back angrily, then eventually conceded, "I am pro-life," adding, "It's a personal decision," she said. Various New York Republican lawmakers came out for Philip Monday night, including Representative Elise Stefanik, a representative of New York. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, of Democrat of New York, joined Swazi on stage at a campaign event this month. However, both candidates distanced themselves from their party's leader. Nonetheless, Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley used the special election as another opportunity to swipe at her competitor, former President Donald Trump. "Everything that he is involved with Republicans. We lose," Haley said. Let me read that again. That quote didn't make sense the way I read it. "Everything that he is involved with Republicans, we lose," Haley told CNN, pointing to a string of recent Republican electoral issues.
And one more political story for this morning. Ohio congressman wants administration to declassify information. The dateline is Washington, D.C., and this is a USA Today story. President Joe Biden's top national security advisor is set to brief congressional leaders Thursday on what the House Intelligence Committee chair called a serious national security threat. Representative Mike Turner, Republican from Ohio, in an ominously worded statement Wednesday, asked Biden to, quote, "declassify all information relating to this threat so that Congress, the administration, and our allies can openly discuss the actions necessary to respond to this threat." Turner did not disclose further details. Jake Sullivan, White House National Security Advisor, would not elaborate on the nature of the threat during a briefing with reporters, but confirmed he took the highly unusual step of reaching out to the, quote, "Gang of Eight," end quote, the top members of Congress to meet Thursday. "We'll have that conversation tomorrow," Sullivan said Wednesday. "From there, we are determined how to proceed. CNN, citing an anonymous U.S. official and two other sources, reported that the security threat involves Russia, which is 2 years into its war in Ukraine. "We have confidence that we believe that we can and will and are protecting the national security of the United States and the American people," Sullivan said. The meeting will include only the four Democratic and Republican House leaders: House Speaker Mike Johnson, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Turner, and Representative Jim Hines, ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, because the Senate is out of session. Johnson confirmed that he will attend the meeting with Sullivan. He wants to assure the American people there is no need for public alarm, he told reporters. "We are going to work together to address this matter, and we do all sensitive matters that are classified," Johnson said. "We just want to assure everyone," I guess this sentence is written kind of oddly, we just want to assure that everyone's have their hands steadily on the wheel. We're working on it, and there's no need for alarm. Representative Mike Garcia, Republican of California, a member of the House Intelligence Committee, told USA Today the threat warrants declassifying, and I think it warrants all hands on deck to get knowledgeable about and be aware of it, declining to add specifics about whether the threat was immediate. And there's a quote here from Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, and he said, "We are going to work together to address this matter as we do all sensitive matters that are classified," Johnson said. "We just want to assure everyone's steady hands are at the wheel. We're working on it, and there's no need for alarm."
Fears increase for civilians in Rafah. Negotiations continued Wednesday in Cairo for the second day as multiple countries attempted to forge a diplomatic agreement for a pause in the fighting in Gaza and the release of hostages. The meetings were extended from Tuesday when leaders from the U.S., Israel, Egypt, and Qatar did not reach a breakthrough but agreed to continue consultation and coordination, according to Reuters news agency. Among the main issues preventing a deal is Israel's pledge to crush Hamas and remain in charge of security in Gaza after the war, and Hamas's demands of a permanent ceasefire and the withdrawal of all Israeli troops from war-torn territory. On Wednesday, the office of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel has not received what it called any new proposal from Hamas on the release of hostages. The statement called Hamas's demands delusional and said only a change in Hamas's position will allow the negotiations to advance. The back and forth is occurring ahead of an anticipated Israeli ground offensive in Rafah, the southernmost city in Gaza, where 14 million people have crowded in search of safety from the war. Israel says the operation is necessary to dismantle Hamas' final stronghold, while humanitarian organizations, including the UN, warn an invasion of Rafah could be disastrous. Israel has launched deadly airstrikes of Rafah in operations it has said are part of a hostage rescue mission, which brought two captives to safety on Sunday. Dozens of Palestinians have been killed in airstrikes targeting Rafah since the weekend. Civilians have begun to flee. President Joe Biden on Sunday cautioned Israel not to invade Rafah unless there's a plan that ensures the safety of civilians packed in overflowing shelters and sprawling tent encampments throughout the city, which has a pre-war population of roughly 280,000. An Israeli evacuation proposal for Rafah includes 15 campsites of about 25,000 tents built across southwestern Gaza and field hospitals controlled by Egypt, the Wall Street Journal reported, citing Egypt officials. On Sunday, Netanyahu told ABC that Israel will provide safe corridors for civilians to flee Rafah and escape to areas cleared by the military. But humanitarian aid groups said there's no place for people sheltering in Rafah to go, and that large swaths of the territory have been destroyed by Israel's military operations, including Gaza City and Khan Yunis. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has said little and has trickled into northern Gaza in recent weeks. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has said that little aid has trickled into northern Gaza in recent weeks and that hundreds of thousands are facing a growing threat of starvation. Egyptian officials and a Western diplomat said if waves of Palestinians trying to flee Israel's invasion of Rafah enter Egypt, the country would suspend the Camp David Accords of the late 1970s, the Associated Press reported. More than 28,500 people, mostly women and children, have been killed in Gaza since October 7, when Hamas launched an attack on Israel, killing about 1,200 people and taking 250 hostages, triggering the war. The Israeli military on Wednesday called for the evacuation of Nasser Medical Complex, one of the last operational hospitals in southern Gaza, where thousands of civilians are sheltering, heightening fears of a potential invasion of the facility. The hospital has been surrounded for days by Israeli forces, who said in a statement it had proof that Hamas continues to conduct military activities at the hospital complex and that the place was used to hold hostages. Officials have reported that multiple civilians have been shot as they were attempting to escape the area. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the World Health Organization, on Wednesday said the UN agency had lost contact with the hospital's personnel and that four missions have been denied since the weekend. The Israeli military carried out a series of airstrikes in Lebanon on Wednesday after rockets launched from within the country killed at least one person and injured eight others in northern Israel. Israeli fighter jets struck several Hezbollah targets, including military compounds, operational control rooms, and infrastructure belonging to the Iran-backed military group operating in Lebanon, according to a statement from the Israeli Defense Forces. Hezbollah has not claimed responsibility for the attack. The rockets fired from Lebanon hit an area of Safed, wounding at least 8 people, CNN reported, citing Mogan David Adam, the largest first responders organization in the country. Israel and Hezbollah have traded airstrikes and rocket fire along the border of Israel and Lebanon since the war broke out in Gaza. Israel has evacuated communities along its northern border. The back-and-forth military operation between Hezbollah and Israel have fueled fears of a wider regional war. And for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Dave Stutz and me, Twyla Glenn. And that brings us to the end of our shift. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Dale Finnegan and Dorothy Hockenberg. We will continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And now here's Dorothy with our first opinion.
Our first opinion is from Michaelin Mankel, and she is an Iowa organizer with the national advocacy group Food and Water Watch. She lives in Des Moines. Cancer rates are through the roof. Well, over half our tested waterways are polluted. Water bills are sky high. Year after year, the data tells a story of a worsening water pollution crisis in Iowa. It is clearer than ever that our foolhardy reliance on voluntary cleanup is poisoning us. Experts have known for decades that industrial-scale concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFOs, are water polluters. Yet over the past 30-plus years, the number of large CAFOs in Iowa has more than quintupled. When Big Ag moved in, corporations ran many family farmers off their land and trapped others in contracts that lock in animal-rearing practices predicated on pollution. Today, Iowa is home to more of these factory farms than any other state. Operating as sewerless animal cities, factory farms pump unimaginable quantities of waste into our water. A Food and Water Watch analysis of USDA and EPA data found that Iowa's factory farms produce 108 billion pounds of manure every year. That's 25 times as much as Iowa's human residents. Unlike human sewage, barely a fraction of CAFO waste is monitored, and none is treated. To make matters worse, factory farms stuff animals with pesticide-heavy diets and strict antibiotic regimens to manage the industry's inherently high disease risk. As the saying goes, what goes in must come out. The copious wastewater that flushes out of these facilities is chock full of pharmaceuticals, pathogens, nitrates, and pesticides, all known to cause human diseases, including birth defects and cancers. Iowa's factory farms and the industrial-scale row crops, grown to feed confined animals, have contaminated more than 1,000 miles of rivers and streams, polluting over 59,000 acres of lakes, ponds, and wetlands, contributed to a Connecticut-cut-sized dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And what do we have to show for it? For one, the second highest cancer rate in the nation, with up to 300 cases a year caused by nitrate-polluted drinking water polluted by industrial sources, including factory farms. For another, up to $66 million a year in statewide drinking water cleanup costs, including a $10,000 a day cost for nitrate removal in Des Moines drinking water, where residents have seen an 80% increase in water bills over 15 years. Not to mention tens of millions of dollars lost in recreational business, the list goes on. For years, Iowa legislators have allowed factory farms to operate with little to no oversight. According to an estimate from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, less than 4% of CAFOs even have a water pollution discharge permit. But it does not have to be this way. It is abundantly clear that our voluntary approach to pollution reduction has failed.
I'm going to take over from Dorothy for a little bit here. Lately, Iowa regulators have done more to enable water pollution than prevent it. The legislature's high-profile decisions last year to defund statewide water quality monitoring equipment and complain about a clean water advocate on the University of Iowa faculty who then left underline this fact. Democrat or Republican, rural or urban, farmer or not, we all drink the water. It's time to get serious about clean water in Iowa. That means treating factory farming as the polluting industry it is and holding it accountable. By our estimate, nearly 4,000 Iowa factory farms are operating today without water pollution permits. The Clean Water for Iowa Act would require all factory farms to obtain water pollution permits, finally bringing their regulation in line with that expected of other industrial operations, from coal plants to paper mills.
The Iowa Act.
From coal plants to paper mills. I'm just going to go ahead and finish up this opinion and then let Dorothy do the letters. So, let's see. Okay, furthermore, the Clean Water for Iowa Act would finally provide the public with much-needed information about which facilities are polluting and where. It's time Iowa moves beyond voluntary half measures and gets serious about clean water. The Clean Water for Iowa Act, introduced February 7th, is the legislation to get us there. And again, that opinion was written by Michaelin Mankel, who is an Iowa organizer with the National Advocacy Group Food and Water Watch, and she lives in Des Moines. And here's Dorothy with letters to the editor.
Letters to the editors. This one from Don Pollen of Cumming. Get Biden off script and Trump on. President Joe Biden could put to rest the accusations that he is losing it by going for a month without using a teleprompter. President Donald Trump's image might improve if he only used a teleprompter and followed the script written by his staff. That from Don Pollen of Cumming. This next is from Harvey Harrison of Des Moines. Let's get independent evaluation of candidates. Good morning, President Biden and Mr. Trump. I offer a challenge to each of you. Fitness for office has become a major campaign theme this year. While I do not think this is the most important issue this campaign season, I do believe that you each has the opportunity to address it and put the issue to rest. My challenge to you is this. Immediately contact the Mayo Clinic or a mutually agreed upon medical institution of equal stature and make yourself available now to that institution. Schedule a complete and thorough examination to be performed before your convention and authorize the institution to release all the results to the public. The following testing to be done. A complete physical examination. Testing of your memory and mental fitness to preclude the possibility of dementia and or Alzheimer's. A complete psychological evaluation. The testing will be done as soon as possible before your convention. No test results will be released until both of you have completed all tests. A refusal to participate in this challenge, or any part of it, will be an admission on your part that some serious problem exists in one or more of these areas that should preclude you as a potential candidate for president. Thanks in advance for your willing cooperation. That from Harvey Harrison of Des Moines. This next from Tim Gracie of Des Moines. Religious right takes away freedom. Clearly, many Republicans do not trust Iowans to conduct local business. Typically, library boards make decisions about book content, and city councils appoint library board members. Republicans seem not to trust anyone to make their own decisions, be they health decisions or how their children identify in school. The religious right is now in charge. I miss the days when it was okay to work with people you don't always agree with. Congressional members now judge potential bills by how they or their party will benefit, rather than if the public will benefit. A sad state of affairs indeed. That from Tim Gracie of Des Moines. This next is from Michael Jones, also of Des Moines. DMPS music changes take away opportunities from kids. As a former music educator, I am saddened to hear that the Des Moines Public Schools will be removing instrumental music opportunities from the elementary school program. DMPS has had a long tradition in providing group lessons in both band and strings at the elementary level. The superintendent commented that delaying instruction until sixth grade pushes it back only 1 year. However, until recently, string lessons began in fourth grade, which is a difference of 2 years. There would be nowhere else in the curriculum where we would be okay pushing instruction back by 2 years. The foundations of good practice routines and the ability to develop a good ear are always more beneficial the earlier they can be taught. The rationale for the cuts to elementary is to bolster staff at the middle school to help retention. If that's the case, then we should look at cuts to administrators and central office staff to provide more teachers for the middle school programs. This proposal shouldn't be done at the expense of our elementary students in a district that already has many families who lack the necessary means to provide these opportunities that make for a richer educational experience. The administration says that the elementary general music teachers will help strengthen classroom experiences with instruments, so students won't actually miss out. This is a blatant diversion tactic, since many music teachers struggle with having enough time and resources to teach with as it is, and most are trained as vocal rather than instrumental teachers. The district always tells teachers to do what's best for the kids. Now it's time for the district to out its money where its mouth is, and that from Michael Jones of Des Moines. And this last one is from Dan Towers of West Des Moines. Grassley chooses obstinance over progress. I am not surprised, yet still disappointed, by Senator Chuck Grassley's vote not to proceed with debate on bipartisan immigration measure. Not surprised because he previously ignored clear constitutional language that hearings be held on President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee. This was an obvious political decision. Disappointed because he has once again caved into those who are more interested in advancing a political point of view than in debating urgent legislation to protect our border and to support our allies. The bipartisan bill is not perfect. However, it is a start to begin fixing our border chaos. It increases personnel and technology and has the support of the border control agents. It begins to make needed improvements to our asylum system. It ties military assistance to border security, all things that Republicans insisted on. Our border security is broken, but so is our Congress. Other attempts in 2013 and 2018 were also torpedoed because Congresses that Grassley was part of chose to treat border security as a political issue. He claims to be in Washington to get things done for our country and for Iowa. Get acting, do something. That from Dan Towers of West Des Moines.
I'm doing this one. The third opinion is from Steve Westerberg, and the title given is Armed School Staff Would Make Things Worse for Kids. I incorrectly assumed the tragic school shooting in Perry would result in the usual inaction by Iowa's politicians. However, last week, Iowa House Republicans introduced a bill, House Study Bill 675, to allow teachers to be armed with guns. Predictably, their solution to gun violence is more guns. Apparently, those who promote arming school teachers believe a solution to school shootings is forcing all students and staff to be comfortable working and learning in a climate with guns. This is far from the truth. If teachers and administrators felt requiring adults in schools to carry guns would make schools safer, wouldn't they be demanding this? They're not. Even five trained police officers employed by the Uvalde School District failed to stop the killing of 19 children. It's foolish to believe school teachers would be more effective. Those who advocate for guns in schools belong to a culture that believes more guns make everyone safer, and guns are the solution, not part of the problem. Those who align with the culture of guns have made guns a part of their lifestyle. For those entrenched in the culture of guns, gun ownership goes beyond a shotgun or rifle for hunting. Carrying a gun is part of the family routine, and for many, just one gun isn't enough. Children in these families are accustomed to seeing guns. In fact, it's just part of their life. What politicians don't seem to understand, or refuse to accept, is that many Iowans are not part of this gun culture. This is especially true for teachers and students. For them, guns aren't viewed as a source of comfort and safety. Guns are meant to be in the possession of soldiers and law enforcement, not their teachers. For them, guns elicit fear and anxiety. Minority students and those living in high-crime neighborhoods see firsthand the destruction guns bring to their neighborhoods. The message this legislation sends to students and teachers is that their schools aren't safe, and in response, they must accept the presence of guns. Isn't it enough that we have students as young as 6 years old enduring the trauma of shooter safety drills? Do we really need to replicate the security measures of prisons to make kids safe at school? Iowa is already grappling with an extreme teacher shortage, something Governor Kim Reynolds is finally trying to address with legislation to increase teacher pay. However, no increased pay will stem the tide of teachers exiting the profession when they're forced to accept a culture of guns in their school. How many of Iowa's young people will choose not to be a teacher knowing their place of employment uses guns as an attempt to keep them safe? We are told Iowa will have a new motto that touts its extensive freedoms, but those freedoms are only extended to certain Iowans, a minority of people who embrace the culture of guns. These folks are afforded the freedom of near unfettered access to guns. Yet if this bill becomes a law, teachers and students must forfeit their freedom to work and learn in an environment free from guns. And this opinion was written by Steve Westerberg of Forest City, who served 40 years as a public school teacher and administrator. Dorothy, are you going to read another opinion before we get to sports?
Okay, we're going to turn to Dear Abby now. Boy's poor eating habits frustrate his grandparent. Dear Abby, my 12-year-old grandson eats nothing except fast food and refuses everything else. His parents allow it and even have food delivered for him. His 8-year-old sister watches closely and is starting to head in the same direction. What they do at home is one thing, but it's a problem for me when they visit, especially for 3 or 4 days. Help! That's from frustrated cook. Abby says, Dear cook, have the child's parents considered that their son may have an eating disorder? If they haven't, it may be time for them to discuss his eating habits with his pediatrician. Although some children may be spoiled and catered to, others may need medical psychological intervention. Because this presents a problem for you when your grandchildren visit, rather than waste the food they refuse to eat, have their parents send their food with them. Dear Abby, I am 4 feet 11 and wear a size 5 shoe. Yesterday, my husband and I went to a department store to buy a pair of slippers for him that were on sale. The slippers were kept where socks are sold, not in the shoe section. So there was no chair for him to sit on to try them on like there is in the shoe section. He has balance issues. I then went to check out shoes for myself in the shoe section. And guess what? The rack was so high I couldn't reach the box, let alone see what was in them. This has happened to me several times. Short people wear small-sized shoes. And as you can guess, the largest size was on the bottom. I'm sure shoppers who wear large sizes don't appreciate having to drop to the floor to get their shoes. Is anyone thinking out there? It's just common sense. And that is from Small Gal in Pennsylvania. Abby says, Dear Gal, speaking as another short person, 5'2½" and shrinking, I feel your pain and agree with your logic. What I say is this. Talk about this with the store manager, and perhaps they will rethink about how shoes are displayed. It's worth a try. This next one is, Dear Abby, in his last days, my stepfather asked that I not tell my brothers, my mom, his ex, and other family members about his cancer. I struggled with it for months. After his passing, the family found out I had known and hadn't told them, and they blamed me for not telling them. I told them he didn't want them to know. They said he didn't mean it. Oh, yes, he did. The problem with them is they are drama-filled, which is why even I usually don't deal with them. They called me names, but I was only doing what he specifically asked me to do. How do I deal with this? Abby says, Oh, that is from Sad Stepson. Abby says, Dear Stepson, your brothers appear to be blaming you because they weren't as close to their stepfather as they might have been. I will assume that you see them infrequently. If you must see them and the subject comes up, repeat this mantra. Dad asked me not to say anything. If he had wanted you to have that information, he would have told you.
I've got a couple minutes to give you a little bit of an update on sports. Tonight, Clark excited for chance to break record at home. This is, of course, about college women's basketball. in Iowa City tonight. Caitlin Clark needs just 8 points to break the all-time NCAA women's basketball scoring record. And the Hawkeyes will take on Michigan tonight. I'll tell you a little bit more about some things you might want to watch on TV. In addition to that game, college basketball for men at 5:30 p.m. on BTN. You can catch Northwestern at Rutgers. At 6 p.m. on CBSSN, you can watch UTEP at Western Kentucky. And on ESPN, Temple at Florida Atlantic. Tonight at 7 p.m. on ESPNU is Winthrop at Radford. And then at 7:30 p.m. on BTN is Minnesota at Purdue. Moving on to women's college basketball, 5 p.m. tonight you can catch NC State at Notre Dame on ACCN. And I don't know if it does not look as if the Iowa women's basketball game is going to be on television tonight. Other games that you might be interested in would be 6 p.m. on ESPN, South Carolina at Tennessee. At 7 p.m. on Peacock, Michigan. Oh, there we go. Michigan at Iowa. That will be on Peacock at 7 p.m. tonight. That's the women's college basketball game where Caitlin Clark will need 8 points to get that college record. Let's see. In college, there's some college softball going on tonight if you're interested in watching that on ESPNU at 9. No, that's during the day today, so we've already passed that time. Let's see. There's a couple more women's basketball games you might want to watch at 8 p.m. on SECN, Vanderbilt at Texas A&M. 6 p.m. on ESPN is South Carolina at Tennessee. And 6 p.m. on SECN is Kentucky at Auburn. If you're not going to watch the Michigan-Iowa game at 7 p.m., you can catch Duke at Virginia Tech on ACCN. And that is about all. There's another little headline at the bottom for basketball. College men's basketball on Tuesday night writes, half-court buzzer beater gives Drake a win. This happened in Evansville, Indiana. Ayton Wright's near half-court heave to beat the buzzer sent Drake men's basketball past Evansville 78-75 at the Ford Center on Tuesday night. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. Earlier, you heard Dave Stutz and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings come from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.